Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Cheeseborough, President of the Association for Enterprise Information, Vice President, National Defense Industry Association, where we will chat on FEPO, that is the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations, Enterprise Architecture, Agile, and other topics. Dave, you've got this really incredible background. You know, you've done so much. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
Well, Stephen, thank you. I'm honored to have this opportunity to talk with you. Your work is well known and your contributions to ICT around the world are very important. So again, I'm honored to have this opportunity.
Now, Dave, you're a mover and shaker, definitely worldwide and also in the U.S. What is your role with the Association for Enterprise Information, and can you describe the value of the association to the broader industry and to professionals?
So my role here at AFEI is to be the president of the association, and in that capacity, I provide long-range strategic planning and assessment and guidance, as well as operational day-to-day management of the various activities that the association engages in. AFEI is unique in that we take an enterprise perspective of the intersection of information technology and business, particularly as it affects our relationships between government and industry. Being here in the Washington, D.C. area, that's an important nexus of the activity that we do. And our value has become that of a trusted and neutral party, where we foster collaboration between government and industry. These collaborations address issues of enterprise information with some degree of objectivity. We try to remove all of the marketing and promotional content that generally comes with folks who are trying to sell into government. And then we provide forums that allow government to hear industry concerns and for industry to get insight on issues government needs to address. So essentially, we buffer the conversation by taking that marketing and sales content out of it. We eliminate the possibility of unfair exposure, take that out of the equation, and we enable individuals, members of the association, our corporate members, to show their expertise and leadership through these activities and make valuable connections that enhance their careers and their marketing goals.
You know, it's a fascinating role that you have in such a very important organization. At times, there must be some tension.
Well, there is, Stephen. There's always tension. And I know that we're going to talk a little bit about the National Defense Industrial Association that we are a member of, or a part of. But part of that tension is that with a deep and broad membership base, there are always conflicting priorities and agendas in that membership. So we're all kind of walking a tightrope many times between what one part of the industry wants to do and another part of the industry. So you're absolutely right. There can be some contentious discussions from time to time.
Dave, I can see this as great preparation as you become ambassador under another future presidential administration.
Well, I don't have any political aspirations, and I try to fly under the radar, but certainly would be an interesting thing to do as we get a little further along here.
Now, Dave, you're also, and you sort of alluded to this, you're vice president of the National Defense Industrial Association. And again, what are the objectives of the association and the value delivered to industry and professionals?
Well, that's correct, Stephen. Basically, NDIA is the leading association for industries that serve defense preparedness and national security. So anything that we do as AFEI has at least one foot in the whole national security arena. But NDIA provides a legal and ethical forum for government and industry to exchange information on national security and issues important to the membership. The members fostered the development, of course, of innovative and superior equipment for defense, for training warfighters, first responders. NDIA has some 40-plus topically focused divisions, things such as systems engineering, homeland security, logistics, It has local chapters around the country, like many associations do, and affiliates like AFEI and the National Training Systems Association. And so we do events together, and NDIA pretty much focuses on being the voice for the industrial base and tries to have an impact on issues that are critical to a healthy defense space.
I mean, that makes me curious then. How big is NDI? Or the National Defense Industrial Association, and how big is the Association for Enterprise Information? How many members do you have?
Well, NDIA writ large, the parent organization, has over 1,600 corporate members and upwards of 70,000 individual members. By comparison, AFEI is kind of in a niche. We have about 40 or so corporate members, but all of those members are focused on some form or application of information technology to the enterprise. And we do have some individual members, but we tend to focus more on the corporations that provide either the software or provide integration or consulting services to defense or government customers.
I can imagine the budgets involved in all the expenditures. So both associations would be pretty important and key associations in the United States, and you'd have your handle on many of the key issues in terms of the enterprise and software and hardware and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the key issues right now, Stephen, of course, and you alluded to it, is budgets. What's going on here in the United States with sequestration and Congress's inability to pass budgets is having a huge ripple effect across industry. And the fact that government has curtailed training, curtailed travel, conference attendance has really hurt our business, essentially, because it's those forums that we use to do the collaboration and information exchanges and also to generate the revenue that supports the other work of the association. So it's a difficult time for all of us right now.
You know, you talk about difficulty in terms of the budgets and so on. So that kind of leads into my next question, and that is, what are some of the top challenges that you have faced, and then your solutions to those challenges?
Well, we all face challenges in our careers and have had varying degrees of success in overcoming them. But I'll relate a few to you that I think kind of encapsulate how we progress through our careers. And so when I was a young engineer, solving problems were mostly technical. You know, the challenges were engineering, and I can give you an example of when I worked at Babcock & Wilcox in their nuclear power generation division organization. I was tasked with designing a mechanical solution to the problem of leaking fuel rods in nuclear power plant reactors. And these are a problem because once the cladding around the uranium was breached, the high temperature water would penetrate and leach out byproducts from the fission process into the cooling water and making it highly contaminated. And this contamination, of course, was a big issue for utilities operating the plant. So what we first had to do was understand what was causing this problem before we could devise a technical solution. So what I discovered in examining how these fuel rods were manufactured and transported was that the way they were handled in the manufacturing process before they were placed into fuel assemblies caused the shifting of the contents in the fuel rods. And then after they were loaded into fuel assemblies, they were shipped horizontally on the backs of tractor trailers to the nuclear power plants, where they were, of course, then brought upright and inserted into the core. Understanding that the ability of the pellets to slide back and forth inside these very slender rods, which actually were not much bigger than pens or pencils, created gaps. And those gaps then were essentially unsupported areas where the cladding could collapse, kind of causing an hourglassing effect, and that would lead to cracking and eventually failure. So the solution, actually, once we understood the problem, was pretty simple. We redesigned the interior of the fuel rods to incorporate an upper and lower spring and spacer kind of arrangement, compressing them before the the tube was closed with a weld, and these springs kept a stack of some 144 uranium oxide pellets in compression, allowing them to be handled without causing gaps. And then once inserted into the core and the core came to operating temperature, these springs were of different materials so that the lower springs would maintain their rigidity and keep the core at the right level for optimal physics performance. And so that was, you know, that was just one example of kind of getting creative and making a challenge into a solution. But, you know, as we progress and as I progressed in my career, the challenges got different. So when I was in the Air Force, my job was to integrate experimental payloads with Minuteman I missiles for test programs. And this required bringing various contractors together to get them to solve some of these technical problems in a manner that made our missions a success. And this is where I began to first understand what I would later come to know as systems thinking. And integrating these systems, you had to understand that everything was affected by everything else, and that increasing, for example, the weight of some part might come at the expense of some other parameter of performance. So solving these types of problems really required developing the ability to deal with people, to compromise and negotiate. And of course, as you know, these skills become pretty important as we move on in our careers into leadership and management positions. But I'd have to say that the greatest challenge that I've faced is the one I'm facing now. And perhaps that's true of all of us, that the problem in front of us right now seems to be the biggest problem. But the current problem that we're working on here with the association is guiding its reinvention, perhaps for the third time since I've been here. Now, I took over the association 12 years ago, and it had been focused on commercial electronic commerce. And of course, after 2000, 2001, the e-commerce bubble burst on Wall Street. And when I took over after 9/11, the association was really looking for a reason to exist. And we refocused on net centricity and national security, spent several years reformulating our strategy. And then about 6 years ago, we began to become influenced by the commoditization of IT, coupled with some of the rapidly advancing technologies. And we pivoted towards topics like service-oriented architecture, cloud, cybersecurity. And today the challenge is in a different dimension than that. It really involves the collapse, as I mentioned earlier, of our traditional association product conferences, particularly in the government market. And we have been fortunate in that we have several forward-thinking board members who have kind of guided us towards the creation of sustained, involved communities. And through these, we're able to adjust our value proposition for members and government stakeholders and remain engaged with them. So designing and launching these communities right now is perhaps the greatest challenge that we're facing as we work to grow and expand the association.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about sort of the collapse of conferences with regards to what you're sort of seeing. But I'm seeing that worldwide. I'm finding that numbers are dropping in all sorts of different kinds of conferences worldwide, and maybe that's due to the proliferation of the internet and everything's free and widely available. And I don't know. Do you see other reasons for that?
I think that is probably one of the main contributors to that phenomenon, is that people don't need to go to conferences to learn anymore. You can learn on the internet. One of my board members is very keen on Meetup, where you can have fairly regular informal meetings, discuss particular topics, and there's a real proliferation of those kinds of things around some of the topics we deal with, like agile methods. And so I do think that the pervasiveness of the internet, the explosion of content on the internet, and its availability through multiple device channels, iPads and smartphones and things like that, has really kind of lessened the importance of conferences, or at least has slowed the proliferation of conferences. I still think there is a important value proposition around getting together in person and networking, but perhaps it won't occur as frequently in the future as it used to in the past.
And I'm intrigued by your background. You talked about working in the nuclear industry and in the Air Force. Can you get into more detail, like, what was your majors when you were going to school, and then How did that eventually lead to your position where you're president of one association and vice president of another?
Well, education-wise, I graduated from high school in 1967 and entered what is now known as Clarkson University. It was called Clarkson College of Technology in northern New York State. And I think like most kids at that age, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I wasn't even sure I wanted to be an engineer, but I went into engineering programs and migrated through several majors during the first year or so and settled on mechanical engineering and found that I really enjoyed that. And so I got a BS degree in mechanical engineering then went on into industry and worked for a number of years and decided, having, you know, kind of grown up in the Vietnam War era, that I really felt like I wanted to join the military. I really wanted to be a pilot, but by the time I got around to joining the military, they were shedding pilots as they wound down from Vietnam, and after all that studying to be a mechanical engineer, my eyes weren't up to par for their requirements. So I entered the Air Force and went into missile program. And so as a mechanical engineer, the Air Force, in its wisdom, made me an astronautical engineer and sent me out to Los Angeles and assigned me to the Space and Missile Systems Organization out there, where I was an integration officer assigned to integrate those experimental payloads with the Minuteman 1 missiles that were launched as test programs out of Vandenberg Air Force Base down to Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific. So, you know, that was quite different than anything I had been exposed to up until that time, and was really where I began to understand what integration was all about, systems thinking, as I said, and it was a real broadening experience. And then after that, I left the Air Force, came back to this area, began working in industry, and got really interested in the early 80s in computer-aided design. And one of my favorite classes in high school was drafting. And so this was kind of a natural interest area for me. But I was really intrigued by the whole digital nature of design information. And that led me into something called, that the government, DOD, was starting at the time, 1984, called Computer-Aided Logistics Support, or CALS for short. And this whole idea for computer-aided logistics support came from the fact that in logistics information systems that had been built for the military, none of them could exchange information with each other. So the Air Force could not query the Army about how many tires they had for a certain type of truck. And of course, the reason was very simple. They weren't built to do that. They were built from the ground up to be fully, highly integrated and isolated information systems with specific purposes. The government, DOD, in its wisdom, created something called the CALS Industry Steering Group, which I participated in for a number of years. And that organization is the forerunner of the Association for Enterprise Information that I now run today.
Well, that's a remarkable history in so many different kinds of areas, and you've done a lot.
Well, you know the old saying, an inch deep and a mile wide. Sometimes I wish I had focused more intently on a specific area, but you know, on the other hand, I kind of enjoy having a broad perspective on things, and frankly, you know, like they say, it is what it is. It's where I find myself.
Now, earlier in the discussion, you talked about some of the areas that are of interest to the associations that you lead, and one of them is cybersecurity. So can you talk about some of the changes you're seeing in cybersecurity?
Well, cybersecurity, Stephen, is a complex and shifting landscape, and critically important to all of us. It's important to us as individuals to do things like protect our identity. It's important to corporations and organizations to keep hackers out and maintain the integrity of their information systems. And of course, it's vitally important to government because cybersecurity helps to thwart digital espionage and things of that nature. So it's a serious concern across all industry, and And, you know, we hear a lot about threats to critical infrastructure like the power grid or pipelines. They get a lot of attention. But basically all businesses need to be aware of threats, cyber threats, and they need to take appropriate actions to protect themselves. Here at NDIA, for example, we're engaged in a study that's focused on cybersecurity for manufacturing, especially, of course, in the defense sector, being the National Defense Industrial Association. What we recognize is that there's a digital thread that runs through all corporations and organizations today, and the concern that prompted the study is that manufacturing operations may be less protected than corporate networks. We all have heard stories in the press of certain organizations and countries penetrating defense networks, stealing information. And what we find is that over the past decade, a lot of effort has gone into protecting those networks, corporate networks that house trade secrets or critical defense information. But we also realized that, you know, a lot of information was exfiltrated and stolen. In fact, so much so that some feel that we've really lost what you might call the fifth generation of designs and technology to cyber theft. And so we're really relying on security to keep our sixth generation of systems from being penetrated and stolen through hardened networks. But the problem, what we're finding, is that in the large corporations, while they've put a lot of money and effort into this, they are highly dependent on suppliers. There are, for example, with the F-35 fighter, there are thousands of first-tier suppliers into that program. Some of them are niche technology companies that are fairly small, and their ability to fund the necessary improvements to secure their networks is much less than a very large contractor would have. And so that becomes a concern, because product and process data now flows digitally up and down the supply chain, and these companies operate on slim margins and really can't afford those security capabilities that the larger companies can. So, and we also find that in many cases, they aren't even fully aware that they're targets. It's often said in our circles that there are two kinds of defense companies, those who know they've been penetrated and those that don't. So everybody kind of becomes a target, no matter how small they are, because one of the vulnerabilities is penetration to defense suppliers through their supply chain.
I can see this as a major thrust within the organizations that you're part of, because, again, the proliferation of the Internet, and as you mentioned, a digital thread runs through everything today. Mm-hmm. And there's even this idea of Internet of Things, so it's just going to get bigger. Earlier, you also talked about some of the other topic areas, and I know that, for example, mobile would be a key thrust also. So how are your members dealing with, you know, mobile one, this whole idea of mobile being the priority for everything?
Well, in our business area, it becomes a bit of a concern for a couple of reasons. It's a consumer-driven IT trend, obviously, and it consumes a great deal of our members' time and energy, particularly in the defense and intelligence markets. This BYOD trend, coupled with the cyber vulnerabilities that we talked about, and the sophisticated social engineering phishing attacks that we're seeing now are really of great concern. Relating to the cybersecurity issue, there is always the worry about the insider threat. Mr. Snowden is a good example of that. But related to that is the unwitting insider threat, that person who thinks that they've gotten an email from someone they know or someone they work with, and they unwittingly click on a link and become infected. That's a huge concern for our membership. And in mobility, the ability to have access to corporate information systems 24/7 is a real concern. You know, obviously, it's a great productivity enhancer. But on the other hand, you know, that requires corporate organizations to really be concerned and on their toes all the time about what's going on their networks. And of course, the other concern with proliferation of mobility and connectivity is that it allows work to expand to occupy any place, anytime. It's great to be flexible and respond to clients or organizations when you need to, but you do that at the cost of you know, sometimes employees balance in their lives. And so with that, you know, that's a double-edged sword in many organizations.
You know, all the conferences that I speak at or attend, you know, mobile is a key theme and continues to be and will be for some time. And you see the latest figures. I guess there's something like, 7 billion mobile subscriptions out there. There's nearly 3 billion internet users, and in fact, smartphones now outship regular phones today this year. So It's just I don't know where it's. I mean, you get things like glasses that have embedded technology and so on. So I'm going to be
It's interesting that you bring that up because I remember many years ago reading a paper that was done by a researcher at Palo Alto Research Center, and his whole theme was on ubiquitous computing. And he was saying things like, you know, you would go down the street and telephone poles would have embedded computers, and most people didn't take that very credibly. But, you know, I think it was a little prescient. We're beginning to see that kind of ubiquity of connectivity happening to us, and happening not because we've designed it that way, but happening because the consumers are kind of driving us towards that. And it's really an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, and I guess driving social change as well, and that's impacting our countries, and borders are disappearing in some ways. So I don't know. It's kind of a frightening area and maybe exciting as well.
Yeah, well, you mentioned social change and this connectivity coupled with apps like Twitter have really changed the geopolitical landscape. And it's something that none of us can really predict where it's going to end up, but it's something that we all have to deal with.
Well, I founded a global industry council a few years ago, and the chief scientist for Accenture is part of that, he's gone on now, but at the time he was chief scientist. He set up all the labs for Accenture, and he talked about the fact that people aren't going to work in companies anymore. They're just going to sort of work at home and work on projects, and that could be for 100 different companies, and the corporate boundaries are going to disappear together with government boundaries and things like that. It's just that because of this ubiquity and seamlessness, and communities are really going to be internet-based rather than, you know, corporately based or country-based. So it'll be interesting to see where all this plays out and the impact it's going to have, and what the future is going to be. Not so much for us because we're a little bit older, but for our grandchildren and so on.
Well, you know, it's interesting when people make those kinds of predictions. I remember 20 plus years ago, back in the old CALS movement days, one of the government guys that was deeply engaged with it was speaking about online shopping, which was relatively unknown at that point in time, and his remarks were both prescient and way off base. He kind of predicted that the rise of online shopping like Amazon or eBay, although of course he didn't name them specifically because they were unknown at the time, but he also extended that to say that this would be the death of shopping malls, and that you wouldn't have shopping malls anymore. Well, I'm here to tell you that the largest tourist attraction in the state of Virginia is the mall that's probably 3 miles from my house and continues to expand. So while the internet and online shopping has had its effect on brick and mortar organizations, witness the impact on bookstores, I think that there is an element of society that that will cause some moderation in those kind of predictions. So to say that everybody would work from home and there wouldn't be corporation kind of ignores the fact that you need legal entities to collect taxes and do those other kinds of functions. And until there's a way found around those, I think people will still have corporations that they belong to and work for and that cut them paychecks. At least I hope to for the rest of my career.
another topic area that I know would be a big focus area discussion within the associations that you lead would be big data. And maybe there's a little bit of confusion around big data. What are your thoughts on big data and its promise or maybe its pros and cons?
Well, I think it has huge promise. I think there are pros and cons. David Linthicum is one of my board members, and we had lunch a few months ago and talked about this a little bit. And I think I have to agree with his position that really what's new in big data is our ability to have massive storage and processing and network you know, new technologies that help us deal with massive sets of data that help us solve the whole velocity, volume, variety problem. And you know, and in that, I think there's huge potential for good, but there's also some potential for, let's just say, mischief. When somebody can know about all of your online habits and make conclusions about what they think you would like to see, that's leading us down a path of, I think, you know, something like predictive analysis. And I think making predictive analysis and extrapolating that to making decisions and policy predicated on predictions, you know, could be a bit risky. So I think big data has a lot of promise. I think there are a lot of companies out there that are positioning themselves in big data to take advantage of the hype that's around it, who really don't add much value. And I think there's a lot of hype around this whole notion of data scientists. But nevertheless, I think what's very clear is that the volume of data that's created on an annual basis is something that we've never seen before. It's unprecedented. And in that, there is probably nuggets of value. And the only way to get at that is through data analytics. So, you know, I'm a fan of it. I think it's got a lot of pros, but, you know, some of the cons are how you might use that. You know, it's a technology that can be used for good and bad purposes. And I think, organizations like the NSA and their use of Accumulo have created some angst around how big data could be used to purposes that, you know, society might not generally agree with.
You know, this whole idea of big data, I was at a presentation where it was mentioned that one of the world's largest retailers in food and other areas can predict uptake of certain food products prior to a storm and through big data. And as a result, they can ensure that they have more than sufficient quantity shipped to the location where storms are going to occur. I sit on the board with this gentleman who founded a company called TrendSpotter, and what they're trying to do through their technology and big data analysis, of course, is predictive analysis of trends for marketers or for sales companies, or it could be for governments. I mean, the applications seem endless. If you can get any kind of glimpse of trends that are occurring by mining all that stuff that's out there.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's interesting because if you could, for example, be a little more precise about weather prediction and then correlate that to what you're talking about in terms of product demand, you would be able, for example, to avoid shortages of bread and milk and toilet paper here in the Washington, D.C. area when a winter snowfall is predicted. Of course, and that's what happens. You know, people run to the grocery store and get those essential commodities thinking they won't be able to get out for days. And, if you could predict well in advance that an event is going to happen and the severity of that event, then it might calm down some of that irrational buying that happens around a predicted snowfall here in the D.C. metropolitan area.
Now, I know another topic that's kind of dear to your heart, or at least it's a focus area in the associations you lead, would be things like agile methods and DevOps. Can you talk more about that?
So agile methods really kind of popped on our radar, about 3 years ago when we did a conference on agile methods for DOD. And from that conference, we formed a group that we call the Agile Defense Adoption Proponents Team and have been doing fairly regular workshops and writing of papers since that time. So we've had a great deal of activity in the agile world. And it's been very interesting to me to begin to get familiar with the terminology and the principles and try to understand how those things could be applied to government acquisition programs, especially in DOD. There are a number of studies and reports in the literature and even in the news about how traditional acquisition processes have failed where software or software intensive systems are concerned. Big projects, millions of dollars wasted because they failed to be able to acquire, require, test, et cetera, software in a timely way. We're talking large amounts of money, and I won't cite any examples, but some of these failures are legendary. And so in looking into that, what people found was that the traditional waterfall process of acquisition simply doesn't work for software. This whole notion of spending a great time of energy and a great deal of money defining and fixing requirements up front, this whole systems engineering V kind of approach that's predicated on the initial condition of knowing all the requirements ahead of time, decomposing them into units and building those units up into fully integrated, tightly coupled and designed systems simply is not appropriate for software and technology of today. It works well for in DOD for things like ships and tanks and airplanes, airframes, but it's been a recipe for disaster for systems that are highly dependent on software or, there are solely softwares, things like health records and things of that nature. So this is, I think, where agile principles become useful. The fundamental ideas of quick cycles and just enough documentation and oversight, user involvement along the way, it's key to delivering value in government acquisitions. It's a huge cultural challenge, though, particularly with the parts of the bureaucracy that are charged with overseeing programs, testing programs. And there are some practical issues as well. Scalability, globally dispersed users that you find in the military environment, testing integration into product environments, certification and accreditation. These are all really practical problems and challenges that kind of hinder the widespread adoption of agile methods. So, but there are growing sets of examples where it's really being done effectively. The Marine Corps, the Homeland Security Department, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, for example, the Veterans Administration, they're all using agile principles to essentially get better results quicker and save the taxpayers money. And of course, we're all for that. So I think one, though, as we become more aware of this, one particularly intriguing concept of agile is to fix the time and the budget for programs and allow the technical requirements to flow. This is completely foreign to kind of the systems engineering approach, which fixes the requirements and then tries to manage budget and schedule around that. The DSDM consortium in the UK is kind of a champion of that. And I think the reason it works is that during the requirements definition phases, requirements are often inflated beyond what they really need to be. And so if you allow the process to adjust out those nice-to-have requirements that aren't really essential to the goal of the acquisition, trading those off against cost and schedule, it's a pretty powerful formula, and I think DSDM does that pretty well. Taking Agile to its ultimate end is, I think, DevOps. I recently read the Phoenix Project, sort of a software development version of Eli Goldratt's The Goal. And it's a great read and puts DevOps, I think, in its proper context. One of its authors, Gene Kim, is probably going to be speaking at one of our workshops here in the 2014 timeframe. But it talks about increasing the velocity of capability into operations and reducing friction. And that's intriguing to us because one of the folks that we have come fairly regularly to speak at some of our workshops is Mark Schwartz, who's the CIO of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. And he's often talking about reducing friction and increasing velocity in developing citizen-facing capabilities in his organization. So I think government is beginning to understand this, but they're certainly a generation or more removed from doing this adeptly on a fairly regular basis. So my goal really in Agile for the coming year is to begin to look into DevOps with government and particularly DOD because, in terms of friction and silos, DOD really is a poster child for having a siloed government organization. Their lack of or their ability to slow things down and lack of velocity is pretty legendary. So that's an interesting area for us as we move forward.
This question maybe is a bit out of left field, but I think it's current, and that's this healthcare gov issue. From your perspective, and I know you're not involved in that area of the marketplace, but from your perspective, what created those problems?
I think you cannot underestimate the impact of politics on the building and launching of that technical capability. And, you know, that's like oil and water. Political people are interested in perceptions, and technical people are interested in delivering solutions and capability. And those two things don't mix well together. And something as politically charged as Obamacare, if I may say so, is absolutely the wrong place for trying to launch what is really the most ambitious and largest citizen-facing web portal in U.S. history. And so I'm sure that there was a lot of influence from the political perspective on the technical processes and development. And I have no idea how the company charged with building this website and portal capability actually went about its work, but I do know that the IRS had a piece of this program, and they used agile methods on developing their piece of the solution, and theirs worked really well. It's kind of frightening that the IRS can build something quickly and make it work well, but nevertheless, they did. And so, you know, I think as we begin to learn more about how things were done, and I'm sure there will be studies and reports written, I think we're going to find that, you know, the political influences didn't allow agile processes or even traditional waterfall processes to work well, and resulted in, you know, launching a website that wasn't even fully tested end to end.
So in your response, in your sort of analysis, kind of from a third-party perspective of what occurred, then do you see a place for enterprise architecture in all of this, and do you think it was fully followed? And then as a sort of a follow-up to that question, what are the challenges with enterprise architecture, or EA, and where has it failed? Is it too cumbersome?
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of one of the challenges for enterprise architecture, and that it has been approached in a manner that has made it too cumbersome. So that challenge is really kind of emerged from, you know, the whole history of the beginning of enterprise architecture, rooted in the methods for documenting and planning information systems, and certainly government, and in particular the folks that we deal with at DOD rather, took that kind of view of enterprise architecture, that it was an IT function that documents the enterprise. Consequently, you know, this view put it, I think, in the wrong place. It emphasized documents. Documents became, in acquisition processes, obstacles and burdens, squares to fill by managers, kind of worked against the whole purpose, I think, of enterprise architecture in terms of enabling organizations to make informed decisions and contribute to accomplishing missions and delivering value. So yeah, I think, you know, I think there are a couple of challenges with EA that, as we move forward, need to kind of be overcome. And another one of those is that so far, enterprise architecture is not really a fully accepted enterprise governance practice. And I think another thing, and then one of the reasons that we'll get to for our involvement is in FIAPO, is that we don't have a common definition. You know, you've got different frameworks, TOGAF, Zachman, others. They have their loyal adherents. But there is no comprehensive view about what enterprise architecture is to an enterprise. And so compounding that problem is that architects have often used or gravitated towards terminology that's really foreign to the people who run the businesses. And this kind of makes it hard for architects to convince executives and managers and operators that it has value. You know, it tends to be seen as this IT exercise that can't deliver value and costs a lot of time and money. And until we overcome that, I think we've got some difficulty with positioning of EA.
So it's interesting then, how do you see EA evolving, and what will it look like in, let's say, 5 years?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting question. I think you have to go back and look at the root in IT of EA, and there's real kind of conundrum around that. And, you know, I think that if we can evolve EA to become dynamic, to kind of reflect agile principles in terms of just-in-time and just-enough discipline that adds value to decision-making for complex problems, then it will thrive. And then my hope is that it becomes more process-oriented and less artifact-oriented, and that it does become as dynamic as technology and business is today. And that in that way, EA can find a way to support future business needs. And that's why I like what FIAPO has done with their work to promote the EA profession. It's a very useful organization, and we're delighted to be a part of it.
I'm Canadian, so I pronounce FIAPO FIPO.
We'll go with the Canadian pronunciation for this interview.
Which is the Federation of Enterprise Architects Professional Organizations.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought it up. And you indicate you're a member of FIPO. So what is the value of this new paper they've come out called the FIPO EA Prospectus Paper and their work on career paths and also on the EA body of knowledge?
Well, I think, we talk about EA profession, I think that the contribution of the Prospectus paper is to appropriately position and define enterprise architecture. I think it captures the essence of the value of enterprise architecture and the need for it to become a core value of an organization. And I think the career paths work is essential as well, but I'm less clear about how a career path for EA should evolve. Enterprise architecture is a young profession, and it has its roots, as we've said, in IT. The Prospectus paper and other writings today tend to want to move IEA into the C-suite as a part of strategy, which I think is the right thing to do. But in the end, the conundrum we face is that many people today feel that IT is the business. And I think what they mean by that is that there is hardly a business today that isn't run by information technology. And so I think we have this dichotomy of not understanding yet whether enterprise architecture is an IT function or a strategy, corporate management function, or is it both? And I think there's some evolution to do there to move us forward. And I think FIPO is one of the organizations well positioned to help do that.
Well, I guess that leads to my next question. And you talked about FIPO playing a role in the evolution of EA, enterprise architecture, and as a discipline and as a profession, and to support government and industry, business, academia, society in general. Can you tell us more about the value of FIPO from your perspective and why you're involved?
We began having conversations with Brian Cameron from Penn State, who is the president of FIPO at this point in time, a number of years ago. We were doing a conference for the Defense Department on enterprise architecture, and they had a lot of money invested in what they called DODAF, the DoD Architecture Framework, and we're percolating that along. We were building a community of interest around enterprise architecture, having some success at communicating its value to senior executives. And so we brought Brian in, because of his interest in the Penn State EA program, and we began talking about certification. And from some of those conversations, we expressed an interest in joining with him in creating whatever organization might be evolving from that. And of course, FIPO was the result of that. And we saw a decided gap in understanding in DoD and its suppliers and the inherent value of enterprise architecture to organizations. So we became a charter founding member, and even though DoD has moved now away from their architecture framework and have been embracing the federal enterprise architecture framework, we still think that this is an important area for guidance of the alignment of business strategy and technology, still very, very critical. I'm reminded of back in the DoD enterprise architecture conferences, we had brought John Zachman in a couple of years in a row, actually, to speak. And as you know, John is sometimes credited as being the father of enterprise architecture because of his 87 work on information systems architectures and his subsequent framework. But when he spoke at our DoD Enterprise Architecture events, he relied on overhead projectors and viewfoils, which actually caused us to do a great bit of scrambling to even find an overhead projector. I've heard since that he may have moved up to PowerPoint, but I don't know that for a fact. And while I enjoyed his talks and the logic of his approach and the jokes that he told immensely, I think that his use of that old static technology for his presentation hinted at one of the challenges for EA that we've mentioned, and that is the perception or even reality that it's not dynamic and agile. So I'm hoping that through the work of FIPO, that perception gets changed, and we're delighted to actually be a part of that.
Now, you talked about the DoD moving from their own sort of inspired framework to this federal one. Can you talk about this transition and why it occurred and the advantages of the federal one?
Well, I can only speculate as to the real reasons, and I don't know that the federal approach is any more advantageous than the DoD approach was. DoD characteristically likes to do its own thing. The Defense Department by far has the greatest budget for IT-related activity than all of the other federal departments put together, so they tend to like to do their own thing. I think that, above all, budgetary considerations may have, in fact, been one of the primary reasons that the DoD architecture framework was or has been, I wouldn't say abandoned, but has been kind of moved towards embracing the federal enterprise architecture. And, you know, and DoD is really a part of, in many ways, the whole federal community. And so having its systems built to a different architectural framework than, say, the Department of Justice or Department of Commerce or Homeland Security doesn't make a great deal of sense. So I think budgetary considerations were the catalyst to essentially make a wise decision.
Now, you've alluded to this throughout the interview. It's kind of spilled in here and there. And so I'm going to sort of answer, or I should say, ask this question directly. Can you describe areas of controversy in the areas that you work?
Well, I can address a few of those. We work at the intersection of government and industry, and so at that intersection, you don't have to look very far to find controversy. So let me just point out a couple that we're engaged with. We're working with the DoD intelligence community on looking at business models and licensing around software. Government, unsurprisingly, wants to take advantage of the flexibility offered by loosely coupled services-oriented kinds of systems, wants to expand its ability to use software purchased and developed under one program for other programs. And that's a great concept. It makes a great deal of sense, but it ultimately and immediately runs into problems on both the contractor and the government sides of the equation. On the government side, there is very little flexibility in how they spend money. Congress authorizes funding that flows down through line items for specific projects, and the Anti-Deficiency Act and other laws work against being able to share that money horizontally across other programs, even within the same department or service. So that's a problem that is causing some controversy. And the other area of controversy with regard to that is the concept of building and adopting app stores similar to the Apple concept. The Apple model is one based, I believe, on volume. You alluded earlier in the interview to the amount of smartphones and mobile devices that are shipped on an annual basis. It's a huge number, billions of devices. And so when you look at the successes in the app stores for those devices, you're looking at a volume of transactions that is vastly greater than the kinds of transactions you would expect to see in a government or military environment. So it makes that Apple model not really appropriate for doing things inside of government. Concept is great, be able to go to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency app store and download an app to do this or that. But corporations don't make money by investing their money in building apps against which there's little predictive demand. Angry Birds is a good example of a company that developed a product and put it in an app store and saw a huge amount of activity. I mean, huge. Millions and millions and millions. I mean, my wife is an addict of Angry Birds. I'm not quite sure how they make their money, but that's a different kind of topic. In government, there are a lot more, shall we say, restrictions on, and particularly in DoD, on how you develop and deploy a piece of software. And that costs more money to make software compatible with the information assurance and CNA kinds of requirements. And it's not really acceptable to industry for government to say, you develop an app, you put it in my app store, and if it gets used, we'll pay you an amount of money based on its usage. Industries that sell into national security see that as an unacceptable risk model. So there's some controversy around those kinds of things. And then finally, another area that we experience a lot of controversy in is the government and DoD approach to supply chain risk and cybersecurity. You know, government and DoD in particular favor mandated regulatory approaches to achieving assurance that suppliers are meeting their criteria for, we'll say, things like anti-tamper, program protection, counterfeiting, cybersecurity. Industry, on the other hand, favors a voluntary approach. They don't like to be told what to do. They like to come up with new, innovative ways to accomplish the same kinds of things. And they like to try and avoid what end up being costly requirements that make them perhaps be uncompetitive. It's likely, particularly where cybersecurity and program protection, counterfeiting are concerned, that there will be mandated requirements to find their way into contracts. The concern there and the controversy is that these regulations might be unevenly applied. We've already seen in other areas where if it suits the purposes of a government organization or program, they might waive some of these requirements, thus making some vendors more competitive on a price point than others, and nullifying the impact of the requirement to begin with, and then not really being sure that these requirements will, in fact, really accomplish what they are intended to do and address the real problem. So that's an area of controversy. And then we've already touched on one that's going to be a big area of controversy, has been this year, will be going forward, and that's sequestration. You know, we really need Congress to do its job, to meet its responsibility to pass a budget so that there is a degree of predictability and assurance in what the government's actions are going to be. Right now, there's so much uncertainty and unpredictability that companies don't really know how to behave in this environment. So they're not expanding, they're not doing the kinds of things that companies like to do. And so that's a real controversy right now here in the States.
So Dave, we're going to now shift gears and maybe take some sort of broader questions, and we're down to our last three. And this first question in the series is about EA as a recognized profession. So, you know, we have accounting, which is what, 1,000 years old, something like that. We have medicine and law, and they've been professions for forever, basically. And then we have this thing called EA, a young upstart, or even computing in general, which is still relatively young compared to the other professions. So do you see the evolution of EA as a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics and a discipline process for those who breach it, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
You know, Stephen, I read what Mr. Saito of Toyota said about this in your interview with him, and I have to agree completely. You know, the professions that you compared EA to are centuries old, thousands of years old in some cases. And these professions have adopted standards over time that have made them into generally recognized professions that they are. And in some sense, society had created a demand for the services of these professions. And that had a lot to do with their development as well, as did, I think, the drive of practitioners in these professions to constantly evolve, improve, and grow their profession and capability and prestige. You know, we all know that we need a doctor to help us with health issues. We need an accountant to help us with our financial issues. Corporations all know they need to have CEOs and legal departments and so forth. So I think until there is a generally accepted demand for an enterprise architect, we'll struggle with the professional development standards. And I think there's another key dimension to this as well. You know, a number of years ago, I became a registered professional engineer. And in that process, I was required to first show that I understood the technology by passing the fundamentals of engineering exam. And then I had to work for a number of years and demonstrate and document relevant engineering experience. And then finally, I had to sit for the professional engineering exam, which was probably the most comprehensive and difficult exam I've ever taken in my life. 8 hours, four questions in the morning, four questions in the afternoon, a booklet of questions that you could choose any problem from, and completely open book. You could bring as many references in to the exam as possible. It was a test of your ability to solve real-world problems and thereby be able to practice the profession. Until we get there with EA, you know, all of the work on ethics and accountability and quality is extremely important, but we need to be able to get there so that at some point in time, in the maybe the distant future, I'm not sure when, you know, state licensure boards will have examinations for enterprise architects and we'll license them. So EA is a young profession. It's evolving. It's some way kind of caught in that, you know, the whole Moore's Law kind of cycle of rapid changing technology. And I'll go back to kind of earlier comments on agile methods and DevOps, because I think we need to see enterprise architecture in the context of these high velocity, low friction organizations. And if we can, then I think there's every possibility and chance that enterprise architecture becomes a profession like law, accounting, and medicine. But it's going to take, you know, the determined efforts and a work of dedicated organizations like FIPO to accomplish this.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the example of engineering because you are a professional engineer, a practicing engineer, and, you know, those are your roots. It's interesting that a few years ago a group came together to make software engineering a profession, and they came up with a principles and practice exam, this professional engineering exam that you just talked about, and you need a critical mass. I think it's 10 or 15 states, and that critical mass was reached, I guess, last year to move forward with making software engineering a profession, and sort of recognized as such. What I mean by that is you graduate from an accredited program, an engineering program. You write that fundamentals of engineering exam that you talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then you practice for at least four years. And then you sit for that PE exam, that principles and practice exam, or professional engineering exam. Never before has there been one for software. Well, now there is one. And this year, they did the first sitting. And the reason this happened because this critical mass of licensing boards agreed to support it. And I think it's 10 states, something like that, agree to support it, which means now it's official. So it's interesting from a broader sense that ICT or IT has kind of moved in this area. And then it'd be interesting to see if the niches within IT, this, you know, broader area computing, like EA, will then become part of this over time.
I think that's an extremely important development, and I would be curious about, like certification, whether there is a market demand or a pull for licensed software engineers as opposed to just somebody who's just graduated from, you know, a computer science program and knows some Java or C++. You know, that's going to be an interesting development. I think we have to watch that closely.
You know, it's a conversation that I've had with some pretty interesting people, by the way, because of this thing that's occurred this year in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And then other countries are following it to see what's going to happen. And in fact, one country has decided to start going on this licensing route for IT. And they sort of mandated it within the government itself, and they've established policies and so on. But there's tension, as you can imagine.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah. And I also want to provide a little bit of context. You mentioned Tadeo Sato, and just for the audience, Tadeo Sato is a longtime professor, quite a famous one in Japan at the University of Tokyo. And he's written, books, and he's published hundreds of papers, had a full career at the University of Tokyo as their professor there. In fact, is now professor emeritus. And earlier in his career, he invented digital switching. So you think about that. All of us in our lives, we've studied, like digital multiplexing and all that kind of stuff, right? Time division multiplexing. He invented all that.
Mm-hmm.
And which is the basis for all digital communications worldwide. And in fact, at one time, every communications company in the world at some point was using some of that technology that he invented. After he left the University of Tokyo, he then became CTO for Toyota, which is where he is at now. So I just wanted to give a bit of context to Dale Seidel because you mentioned them.
Well, that must be a fascinating position, because think of all the technology that comes together in a vehicle today. One of our board members works for a company called International Techno Associates, and they work with the automobile industry. And he was telling me an anecdote a while back about BMW. And we were talking about embedded software, and there's some 200 processors in a BMW. And he was saying that BMW had gotten their design time for a new vehicle down to 2 years. And then along comes all this embedded software and processors, and that's been pushed back now to 3 years because of all this. So the intersection of these technologies in a vehicle like a Toyota or a BMW must be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I guess you really are at the forefront of all of these sort of domains that are coming together in a vehicle. And it's interesting sitting down with Tadeo. It's funny, he's got this second career after retiring from teaching for, 35 years or something, but just a fascinating individual. In fact, I was with him at in September, he was at the General Assembly for IFIP. Mm-hmm. He was there. And then, of course, I met him again at the World Computing Congress where he was. If you ever get in a conference, or if you get a chance to meet today, I'll sit down and talk with him. He probably has a picture of the world that's sort of 10 years what we know of, right? So.
Yeah, and, it's fascinating that he kind of reversed the trend of having a career in industry and then going into teaching. He sort of had a career in teaching and then went into industry. That would be an interesting conversation to have.
Right, and it's probably only possible in Japan, because normally when you spend 30 or 35 years in teaching, you're retired.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to, at the age of 65 or he's an older person to get invited to then hand up, research within Toyota, a $270 billion company, right? So Now, Dave, we're down to our last two questions, and, you're this notable leader, you're widely acknowledged, internationally respected, and you've done some amazing things in your life, and you speak widely, travel, and work. Are there interesting stories that you can share, maybe something amusing, surprising, and so on?
Yeah, I think I've been very lucky and fortunate to have had jobs that have allowed me a great deal of international travel to many parts of the world. And, I think travel is absolutely necessary to broaden one's horizons and gain exposure to different cultures. And it gives you some really great experiences if you're open to them. So I'll just relate a couple to you here. My first business trip outside the U.S. was on a Navy project to go to Saudi Arabia. And it was a real eye-opener for a young engineer, that it was a barrage of new experiences, each one a little stranger than the one before it. And it began with a flight from JFK to Rome for a layover. And about an hour out of Rome, the fire brigade at the airport in Rome went on strike. And so all flights were diverted, and my 747 ended up in Nice, France. And after some negotiation with the airport authorities, who quite frankly weren't expecting a 747 full of foreigners to land at their airport, we were allowed to sit in a departure lounge for a few hours. And the strike ended. We boarded the plane and headed to Rome. And we were landing in a thunderstorm. And as we got to about 500 feet above the airport, the plane was struck by lightning. And, of course, nothing happened. There was no crash, and planes are designed to deal with those kinds of things. But that was a little disconcerting. And then on deplaning, one of the first sights I was greeted with were Carabinieri in the airport carrying automatic weapons. And this is the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. So we and my traveling companions and I checked into the Cavalieri Hilton in Rome to stay overnight. And when I got to the room, I turned on the radio. And so here I was in Rome, Italy, listening to the BBC, and they were playing Willie Nelson. And I just sat down and thought, this is just a surreal experience for a small town kid. And then later on that same trip, the three guys I was traveling with, we decided to rent a car in Saudi Arabia and drive from Riyadh to Jubail on the Gulf Coast, which was our next place of business. And I recall very vividly driving over a hill about 30 miles outside of Riyadh on a modern six-lane highway, you know, freeway kind of, and about 30 miles out of Riyadh, we come over this hill and the desert has completely covered the road. There's sand dunes, and we see off in the distance, there's an old road and we see some tire tracks across the desert. So off we go across the desert, hoping to make it over to the old road and continue on our journey, which we did. But those kinds of experiences are just, you know, they're priceless. You can't get those in a movie. You can't read them in a book. You have to live them. And then the other experience I'll relate to you was my first trip to Japan. And I was a speaker at a conference there, and our Japanese host had a formal dinner at a very traditional Japanese restaurant with women dressed as geishas, as servers. And not long after all of the welcoming speeches, they broke out the karaoke machine. And every one of the Japanese businessmen sang an Elvis Presley song in English. And it was pretty clear to those of us from the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia on the opposite side of the table that they took this singing pretty seriously. And we all kind of looked at each other and knew we were in trouble. I'm pretty sure they take lessons in that, you know. And when it came to be my turn, I selected a song that I thought I knew called Locomotion. I don't know if you know the song, you know, goes, come on, baby, do the locomotion. So I gave the geisha girl, waitress, the number of the song, and she punched it up in the machine. And I stood up with a microphone, the music started, and the words came up on the screen in Japanese. And I panicked, and I started singing in some mock oriental language, and which kind of brought them to tears. I don't know if it was laughter or something else, but they didn't let me off the hook. They restarted the machine, and I had to sing the whole song in English again. And I never knew how long that song was till I had to sing it in front of a bunch of businessmen. So, you know, you never know what you're gonna run into on travel, and it's good to be open to experiences because they create great memories.
I'm just thinking that you probably experienced time dilation when you were having to sing that song.
Yeah, I'm sure I did. It was a weird sensation.
Well, Dave, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, Stephen, I might ask about secrets of success, and my answer to that would be that there really are no secrets. Success requires a good start with education, determination to succeed. I believe attitude is essential, as is preparation and lifelong learning. Another question might be about management style, and I would answer that the secret to management is really taking the high road and treating people fairly. Having openness in your communication and building trust is essential. And then finally, I might ask about goals, and I would answer that everyone ought to have goals that they strive for, but they should not be a slave to them. You know, the one goal that people really ought to have and that matters is having balance in life, balance between work and family. You know, recreation, hobbies, they're all essential to being a well-rounded professional. So that's my quick answer to what three questions I might inject.
Dave, I really enjoyed this time with you. It was great to hear many of your insights and experiences from a notable international recognized top executive leading some of the top associations worldwide. So, you know, I thank you for coming in today to do this interview, and especially with your very demanding schedule, and again, sharing your many deep experiences and insights with our audience.
Well, Stephen, it's indeed been a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope your listeners find something interesting in this interview.
Well, they definitely will find many nuggets within this interview, and again, thank you. And to close off, I want to say that I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dave Cheesbrough, President of the Association for Enterprise Information, Vice President, National Defense Industrial Association. And we spent the time chatting about FIPO, EA, Agile, and many, many other topics.